Welcome to Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA. He was an easy man to underestimate, perhaps because he was a difficult one to understand. Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev guided the destiny of the Soviet Union through a complex era of growth and tribulation, and a time when the world was brought to the brink of nuclear catastrophe. Through it all, he remained the shrewd peasant from Kalinovka, tough, impulsive, and capable of both good and evil. Above all, he was authentic, and as one man recalled, possessed of that wide-open Russian soul. Another man remarked, all you had to do to understand how Khrushchev could have become so powerful was to look into his eyes. My guest is William Taubman, author of Khrushchev, The Man and His Era. Bill, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you.
Bill, this is a great, big, handsome book you have written here with lots of extraordinary information about a pivotal person in it, a pivotal person in world history, so let's get right to it. I thought, Bill, after having read this book, that the subtitle was extremely well chosen, not just because the man was part of his times, but because his personality and character, I thought, influenced so much of what Russian policy became. A perception I wanted to get your reaction to. His sort of constant need for self-affirmation was, I thought, a driving force. But also this, perhaps more importantly, Bill, I thought of him as a true believer, a real idealist in the kind of the Soviet communist sense. Is that a correct notion?
Well, I think you're right. What we have here is a volatile mixture of ideology and personality. The ideology is communism. He does believe in it, although in his somewhat primitive version, I think it boils down to everybody will live better. Mm-hmm. And the personality is in many ways more complex than the ideology.
Yes, indeed it is. This complex personality ranges. I mean, there's so many aspects to it, but this is a very shrewd man, very poorly educated, and that lack of education seems to sort of bother him all his life, doesn't
it? Well,
this
lack of education is something that everybody has noticed. You can't help but notice when he starts banging his fists, you know,
right,
or waving his shoe. Mm-hmm. And he was pretty crude, too, in many of the things he said. But I think what I discovered was it wasn't simply that he was a primitive that affected his policy. It was how he thought about his primitiveness, how he parlayed it into the image of a kind of simpleton, which enabled him to survive Stalin and defeat his rivals for the top.
That's a marvelous comment, because I said in the outset, I still think of him very much as an authentic person, but he was aware of what he was doing, wasn't he? I mean, to use your verb parlay, he knew how to make use of what he was.
Well, it was very complicated because on the one hand he knew how to use it, mm-hmm. but on the other hand I believe he was mortified by the use he was making of it. That is, he was playing up something that in his heart of hearts he sought to transcend. He didn't want to be a joke, and yet to survive in Stalin's court he had to be a jester.
Right. Let's go back to where this starts. I was struck, Bill, at the start, he was born to a peasant family, but didn't relish being called a peasant. He wanted to be a worker and quickly made himself a metal worker, a fitter, I think, in a mine. And it is in the mines, I think, where his story really begins, isn't it? I mean, the effect he has on his fellow miners in the Donbas region.
Well, the fact that a peasant wants to be known as a miner is quite understandable in a Marxist, or at least a man who turns out to be a Marxist, because after all, it's the proletariat, the working class, that's supposed to make the revolution, not the peasants. So once he becomes a miner and a worker, he throws himself into the movement of other workers for communism and revolution.
And in throwing himself into that movement, he begins right at the start, I was really struck by this, to have an extraordinary effect on people. I got the impression, and do correct me if I'm wrong, that he could make connections very easily with his fellow workers. They sensed something in him that they innately liked, and perhaps more than that.
Yes, he was a. This is difficult thing to say about a man who had blood, as he said in his retirement,
up to his elbows,
right, known as the Butcher of Budapest, right, for the invasion of Hungary. But he was, in some ways, or at least he began life as a nice guy. He was a very likable, sociable fellow, and that too explains how well he does. He's not somebody who is immediately suspected by Stalin, who suspected everybody else.
You know, that's interesting. When that comment, the And he makes it practically on his deathbed when he's, I think, talking to an intellectual about having the blood up to his elbows is his major regret. This may sound extraordinary, and perhaps it's only those who will read this book will understand this, but this duality of this man is striking throughout his life, that he could be capable of really benevolent actions and deep sentimental concern, but also be a butcher when necessary.
Well, another thing he says at the end of his life is, he said, when I die, the historians will place the good that I did on one scale and the evil on the other, and I hope that the good will outweigh the bad. Mm-hmm. In order, of course, to do good in the end, there had to be some goodness in the beginning.
Right.
And I concluded that in the beginning, he really was a decent person who was later corrupted by power, by the search for glory, by misguided idealism. But unlike many of his colleagues in Stalin's inner circle, who became impersonal cogs in the machine, automatons, in him, that decency remained and came out again when it had a chance to do so.
I'd like to probe a bit further in this extraordinary personality that became Khrushchev, the public figure. I sense a kind of romanticism also. I mean, in the sense that he, again, to go back to the true believer comment, unschooled as he was in an impoverished region, he seemed to believe profoundly, not just in communism as a doctrine, but in this kind of paradisical notion that the workers really could achieve this thing worldwide. You know, he was sort of swept up in it in a passionate way.
Well, the reason I don't necessarily accept romanticism as it is that it was so combined with realism that every time you find yourself thinking this fellow's getting carried away, he brings you back down to earth by his understanding of power and the way it works. So the word that I would use instead, I think, is a kind of naivete.
Naivete. Interesting.
Which is also something extraordinary to say about a man with the power that he had, who climbed the bloody pole, who defeated all comers, who wielded power, governed a vast transcontinental empire. How could he be naive?
Well,
he was.
But that's striking, and I'll accept that naivete, but then it makes me think that, and that's even more extraordinary, because here's a man who does all those things, and the naivete, I take as meaning an innocence that's preserved, if you will, at the core of this man throughout.
Well, that's right. And again, how can he be both innocent and guilty? And yet he is.
Yeah.
I think the innocence also took the form in the end of thinking that the socialism in which he believed, or the communism, could be cleansed that of the Stalinist stain and revivified in a way that would capture the hearts and minds of his own people. That didn't happen.
When you mention Stalin, you come to a major theme of his life, a major theme of world history, but thinking of it in the Khrushchev dimension and thinking of it in these early years. Bill, I think the book aptly depicts this kind of wrestling with the Stalin image that he had to do both before he knew Stalin and then when he was part of the inner circle. Was there a phase, and I thought I caught this, where he might have, in the early years, despite his belief that this was the wave of the future, the right philosophy, the right leader, entertained some doubt, some Trotskyist doubt? Was there a moment when he...
Well, there's absolutely... It's documented that in the very early 20s, 1923, he signed a petition supporting the Trotskyite position against Stalin. And once he did that, he had given hostage to fortune. In other words, at any point after that, anybody could have pointed to that and said, you were a Trotskyite, and that would have been the end of him. But he was shrewd enough even to cope with that by taking it to Stalin before Stalin could take it to him and saying, I did this. What would you advise that I do, dear sir?
Why did he do it in the first place?
Well, because he was, I think, in his bones, something of a Democrat. Only, I don't mean this in the technical, full sense. I mean it in the sense that he trusted in the spontaneity of people in whose goodwill he believed. And of course, communism did not do that. It was top down, it was control, it wasn't spontaneity. So that sense, which he later burned out of his own soul, was there in the beginning. And that's why he sided with Trotsky, who at that point was playing up the democratic, allegedly democratic side of communism.
Bill, I like that phrase you used, he burned it out of his soul and mind for decades. But I guess my question is, was he completely successful in that? In other words, did that democratic sentiment, that Trotskyist phase that he had, resurface in a way in 1956 at the 20th Congress when he made that speech denouncing Stalin? I mean, was this something that just was part of him and would not go away.
Yes, I believe it was. It's one of the things, this commitment to a more open, democratic kind of society, which Trotsky was playing on at that time, was something that led Khrushchev to attack Stalin in a speech that, of course, was the beginning of the end for
right.
communism. But it wasn't only that. I think it was also, it was also a series of political calculations, but most of all, and this is the thing I think I discovered in the book, it was anger, it was guilt, it was shame at what Stalin had done, not just to socialism and to Soviet society, but to him. He had taken this good man and shoved his hand in blood up to his elbow and forced him to become an accomplice in mass murder.
You know, as I understand it, Stalin did, he was a tyrant on a 24-hour basis. He would make Khrushchev and others do ridiculous things, dance for his pleasure, consume enormous amounts of vodka. The personal tyranny of that man was as monstrous, I think, as the political tyranny he exercised.
I refer to him in the book as both Khrushchev's mentor and his tormentor.
Yeah.
He raised him up and mocked him as he did so. He made light of him even as he made much of him.
Two things about that. When you mention him as Khrushchev's tormentor, you remind me of what a charnel house the Soviet Union was, just what a madhouse environment it was to live in, to survive in.
It was not simply that people denounced each other in order to gain power, to clamber over corpses up the bloody pole. It was also that there are certain things about it that were positively surreal. You might have an apartment house, somebody living on the fifth floor who covets an apartment on the seventh floor. All they have to do is whisper to the NKVD that the person on the seventh floor has a whiff of treason about him or her, and they're gone, whereupon you can try to get that apartment.
Until someone takes it from you.
From you, that's right.
The second thing that occurs to me, Bill, when you mention Stalin, the tormentor, the monster, he certainly was, is that perhaps that was Khrushchev's path, not just to survival, but to ascendancy. In other words, the fact that he did not represent that much of a palpable threat to Joseph Stalin. He could be tolerated as jester, etc.
Well, Stalin was paranoid. We don't need medical testimony. We can just see the millions of people that he did away with, including his own family and friends. And paranoids don't usually trust people, but Stalin trusted Khrushchev. Mm-hmm. So something has to explain this, and I think it's the seeming simplicity, the seeming artlessness
right.
and guilelessness of this man that led Stalin to actually do more than trust him, but feel a kind of affection for him.
Yeah, because even a monster needs a kind of a stepson or something.
I mean, Stalin, in effect, he didn't rescue or try to rescue his son when he was captured by the Germans. Another son he brutalized. It may be too much. I'm not a psychologist to say that Stalin looked on Khrushchev as a kind of son, but I'm pretty darn sure it's not too much to say that Khrushchev looked on Stalin as a kind of father figure.
It's interesting to comment that you suspected Khrushchev might have looked upon Castro as a kind of son, Fidel Castro, as a kind of son later in this story as well.
Yes, because, Castro was a young man who'd made a revolution in a country close to the United States, in Cuba. This was a feat with which Khrushchev was impressed,
right.
but he was also taken with him as a personality, with his charisma, and the fact that he could be a benevolent tutor to him of the kind that Stalin actually had not been, because he wasn't benevolent, but he
right.
certainly was a tutor to Khrushchev.
Indeed he was. Speaking of his tutorship and Khrushchev's rise, the 30s, I thought, were the period of Khrushchev's real ascendancy. I mean, he supervises the metro construction in Moscow, which is an enormous responsibility. And his time seems to be divided. As a matter of fact, the polar sites of his life, I thought, were Ukraine and Moscow.
The first thing I'd like to say about that rise to power, you're right, in the 30s, first in Moscow and then in Ukraine, is that you can explain it in lots of ways. You can say he believed in the cause. You can say he feared that his neck would be cut. You could say he feared his family would go if he were guilty of anything. But the thing I concluded that was most important of all to him was that he wanted self-respect. He wanted to think of himself as a man worthy of esteem and respect. And the paradox is that he came to think of that when Stalin adopted him and moved him up the ladder.
Right.
Before the most of the blood began to flow, because I think at that point this sense of self-respect became overlaid with a sense of guilt and shame.
Sense of guilt, as it should have, because that tenure in Ukraine was extremely bloody. I mean, there's one source, one colleague of his, I think, who cites the figure 54,000 people on whose execution, he says, Khrushchev personally signed off on.
Well, that colleague is Molotov. And Molotov we can't entirely trust because Molotov had it in for Khrushchev.
Right.
But I did some work in the archives in Ukraine, even some in the secret police archives, and I came across at least one document. I always hoped I would. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to take anything on trust. I came across this one document, which was a case, a sort of folder for a official of the Young Communist League, and across the first page in Khrushchev's familiar hand, familiar to me by that point, was arrest him, N. Khrushchev. Mm-hmm. So we know he signed arrest warrants, we know he sent people into what he later called the meat grinder, and they never returned.
Yeah. He was also, I'm trying to get a sense now, I guess this is the question, I'll just pose it very directly, Bill. The show trials were going on in the same period, were they not?
Yes, they were, 37-38.
37-38, and I got a sense of him as being not a direct participant, perhaps, but a cheerleader, if you will, for these trials, making himself visible in that way.
Well, this sort of fit his character, too, you know, to be somebody who would get up at a parade in Red Square and call for blood of these sniveling dogs of imperialism. It was the sense of, I said, a court jester before, a cheerleader. These were all part of his image as a very lively and loyal guy, but not too deep.
Yeah. There are many marvelous quotes in the book, but I want to quote one right now because I think, going back to this charnel house analysis we were doing that he lived in and survived in, and trying to get a sense of his duality and his method for getting ahead. It's from the book, and it goes, Khrushchev had an appalling ability during Stalin's lifetime and after to separate the horrors carried out by the party from the great cause it supposedly served. Now, that, I guess, in a sentence is what you think he did, this kind of separation.
Well, it reminds us of the famous line that the end justifies the means. The cause is the end. The means are horrendous. But as long as you believe that the end justifies the means, you're willing to let them go. After a certain point, he had no power to stop them. So we're really talking about how he convinces himself that what he's involved in is okay. And the further thing you have to say is that in the end, he does not fully convince himself. Hence this festering sense of wrong that has been done by others, including him.
And throughout that process, I would think he's directly subject to self-deception at every turn. I mean, because he's just constantly trying to excuse these
things. Well, one of his earlier biographers talked about the fact that you couldn't really pin Khrushchev down because so much of what he engaged in, both at the time and for posterity in his memoirs, amounted to deception and self-deception. And as I pondered that, I came up with the point which I make in the book, which is that this is not an obstacle to understanding. This is the point to be understood.
Right.
That there's not only deception, but there's self-deception, convincing himself that what he's doing is all right.
And he was doing that.
I think he had to, you know, to carry on.
The Second World War, perhaps the most dramatic, definitely the most dramatic moment I would think of 20th century history, and certainly for the Soviet Union, for the Communist Party, etc., had to be traumatic for Khrushchev as well in this sense. I think now of the early loss of Kiev and Kharkov, where it looked to me like he had to come to grips with Stalin's fallibility as a marshal, if nothing else.
Well, this too is, it's interesting in a couple of ways. On the one hand, these are two military disasters in which hundreds of thousands of soldiers die unnecessarily. And in his memoirs, this is the second point, Khrushchev blames Stalin. But when you look back, as I did, at the accounts close up of what was going on, you see that Khrushchev himself is partly to blame in the following way. What he does is he and his fellow generals, he's a political officer, but the others are military, they sell Stalin on these operations by telling him, we can defeat the Germans. They oversell him. He goes along with it. The operations begin. The blood starts to flow. The Soviets die. He then gets on the phone and tries to get Stalin to stop. Stalin won't stop. And then he blames Stalin. And he's right, Stalin should have stopped. But Stalin, in effect, had bought into a doomed plan sold to him by Khrushchev.
What else does the Second World War do to Khrushchev? I mean, I have the sense of him at Stalingrad. He's a political officer, is he not,
with
the Russian army? But that he regards that as one of his nobler periods, if you will. What does he accomplish in?
Well, as a political officer, his job is to mobilize the troops, to inspire them, to indoctrinate them. He's not supposed to be planning military operations. He's not really qualified. Of course, that doesn't stop him from doing so. I think for his own development, one of the things he learns is that Stalin, see, he's at the front, he's with these people. He sees them every day, and then he sees them die for no good reason, because Stalin has given stupid orders. So I think this deepens his sense that there's something basically wrong with Stalin. But the fact that he spends 2 or 3 years far from the Kremlin, at the front, where you have to operate independently to survive, I think deepens his sense of independence, of autonomy, and maybe his confidence, too, that if the chance ever comes, that he can do a better job than Stalin himself.
You know, with that answer, you strike an echo in me, Bill, from the book. I hadn't really focused on it until this moment, that's what Stalingrad did. It brought him back to the people. And this was preeminently, if you will, a man of the people. I remembered something, again, from the early years, when he was thinking back to his metal worker days, arduous as they must have been, but fondly remembering that. And I wonder if it's because throughout his life, another duality was that he dealt with power, reached the pinnacle of power, but was ultimately most comfortable with the people.
Yes, he himself, he puts it, he said, I'm not a man of paper, I'm not a paper eater, a guy who sits at his desk and signs orders or draws them up. He was always at his most comfortable when he was on a farm or in a factory or at the front, hobnobbing with people. He was a man who liked to be liked. He liked people and wanted them to like him.
Right, and they did in great numbers.
And that's interesting, too, because I thought that one of the things in his memoirs that gave that away was how he would mention a series of butchers, some of the most bloody associates of Stalin, and he would say, I liked so-and-so, Yezhov. I liked Yezhov. He was the NKVD chief. And I thought to myself, why is he saying this in memoirs dictated after he's out of power?
Right.
What could he possibly gain from saying he liked a bloody butcher? And then it occurred to me that it's almost unconscious. What he's doing is reflecting his likability, wanting to be perceived as liking people and being likable in return.
Goodness, it's amazing, the effective person. I mean, and I think this is what's so rich about the book. We're describing these personal traits and qualities, which are always interesting in any person. But here we'll see them played out in the political themes of his life as well.
Well, I think Khrushchev in that sense is a classic case of personality being decisive in history. There's the great man theory, now great woman theory of history. And you can debunk it in all sorts of ways. You can say it's not the whole story. There are values, there's in the environment, there's situations. But when you find a man like him who has power, who does things that nobody else would do, none of his peers would do the same thing he does, and who seems to be driven by some internal compulsion to act and even to undermine himself, then you can throw up your hands and say, this is a man who is making a difference because of his character, and I think he did.
I find that profoundly appealing because it's, simply put, character matters in a very, very powerful way. Bill, the Second World War again, no country lost more than the Soviet Union did in human terms, paid a bigger price. And I guess the question, simply put, is this. Did the very magnitude of that sacrifice reinforce Khrushchev's sense of the worthiness of communism? I mean, anything that would cost that much to protect simply had to be defended for the rest of one's life.
Yes, I think it reinforced his sense of the worthiness of communism and also of the Soviet people. Any people who could sacrifice on that cosmic a scale deserved better than Stalin gave them, especially after the war when they had shown their loyalty.
Right.
And when Stalin cracked down again and said, I don't care what you showed in the way of loyalty and sacrifice, this state is going to remain Stalinist and reimpose controls and police tyranny and purges and all the rest, I think that Khrushchev, along with many of those people, was disappointed and waited for the chance to reverse that and got it.
We're going to be talking a lot more about Nikita Khrushchev, both in this conversation and one to follow, but I don't want to leave this one without bringing into it another factor that is also as powerful, I think, as character and his formation. That's his family. Nina Petrovna was his third wife, but I think she's the one most associated with him by far, not just because that was the longest marriage, but because she was with him through the most momentous occasions. But it seemed to me, Bill, an extraordinary family to understand because of him and his ties to it, that he was capable both of great emotion but also of some degree of irascibility or alienation from them. I mean, how would you characterize it?
Well, the first thing I would say is that I don't think it's accidental, to use a old Soviet phrase, that both his first wife and his third wife were better educated than he. Uh-huh. I think to marry a woman who's better educated, and in the case of Nina Petrovna, she was actually his teacher. To marry his teacher is to say without saying that you feel the need for enlightenment right. and education and refinement. So that was a very important clue. It's also very interesting that his wife Nina was in some ways a more dogmatic communist than he was. And I think unhappy with him for straying, not sexually, but ideologically. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, it's when you see somebody like Khrushchev within a family, dealing with his children, a wayward son, a difficult daughter, when you see somebody dealing with a family, you get a picture of a complete human being. It's one of the best ways, I think, to resist the kind of political stereotyping, which is all too easy for a biographer as well as for a regular reader.
I agree completely, and I'm very glad you took that approach to this book. As we end this conversation, Bill, and look forward to our next one where we'll go into what he did once in power, let me try your quick, brief reaction to this sentiment I had at finishing the book. I was moved to put upon Mr. Khrushchev a kind of a capitalist accolade, if you will, that he was the quintessential, quote, and here's the accolade, self-made man. Is that right?
He was self-made, but he. One of the things I say is that he couldn't unmake what his native village and his crude peasant background had made of him. So the combination of what his village had made of him and then what he tried to make of himself was a man who was getting there, becoming what he wanted to be, but never finally could. And I think that kind of insecurity, that kind of sense of doubt about himself, which was difficult to see, but it was there, shapes a lot of what he does and what happens to him once he attains full power.
Which is we're going to discuss in our next conversation. Bill Taubman, thank you so much for this one and for the book.
You're very welcome.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was William Taubman, author of Khrushchev. I'm George Listencier, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. Our production assistant is Megan Conway. And our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.